Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Schiff, again, the host of the show Wall Street Unspun. I'm here live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time. You can hear the show on my website also at www.europac.net. www.europac.net. Anyway, quite a bit to talk about again this week. Most particularly, I don't know if anybody saw the most recent appearance that I had on CNBC. I was on CNBC, I think it was Monday, and I happened to be in a bull-bear debate on Kudlow and Company. Kudlow was actually away, but I was arguing about whether or not the U.S. economy was headed for recession, and my opponent in this bull-bear debate was Art Laffer, you know, who gained fame back in the Reagan administration or prior to it because he sketched that famous Laffer curve. Back of a napkin, you know, having to do with if you raise taxes, that actually, you know, you can cut taxes and get more revenue. And so he was my opponent. And I tell you, I mean, this guy, I mean, it's incredible. I don't know what he actually knows about economics. I joke that, you know, he can probably fit the sum total of his economic knowledge on the back of that napkin. And probably still have room left over. But I don't know if anyone saw that. I'd be interested to have you call the show for your comments on how you thought that debate transpired. But anyway, I'm a bit distracted here. All right, there we go. Okay. And let me get back to my computer. I was actually, you know, putting a video in for my kid to watch. And you know, the way they have these videos now, you just can't play it. They make you watch through 5 minutes of previews and commercials, and there's no way to fast forward or skip over it. So you have to sit there and watch them go through. Anyway, let me get the number to call. I want to give that out. The number to call for the show is 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. Yeah, so if you happen to see that show, give me a call. I'd like to get your take on it. You know, also, I did Bloomberg at the end of last week, and I'm going to be on Bloomberg television again for an entire hour, so you might want to make a point to watch that. I'm normally only on for, you know, 5-minute, 10-minute segments, but I'll be on for the entire hour from 11 to noon. I think it's Thursday. I have it on my website, but September 7th, I'm going to be the co-host of the show. And, you know, the last time I co-hosted that show months and months ago, apparently one of the guests that came on complained about me, and they said they'd never go on Bloomberg again because they didn't like what happened. And it shows, you know, how people are not used to getting tough questions. What happened is the CEO of an auto parts company happened to come on, and, you know, I asked them a few questions, and I didn't toss them the normal softballs that they normally get. I basically said, look, you know, your industry is highly cyclical. We're coming off a period of record car sales. Meanwhile, the consumer is loaded up with debt. The housing market is about to go down. Interest rates are rising. General Motors and Ford are having problems. It seems that we're in for a big slowdown in auto sales. Why should anybody buy your stock? You know, wouldn't it be better to wait for the price to drop and buy it, you know, when it's depressed? And so apparently he didn't appreciate me raising the possibility that his stock might actually decline. And so, you know, it took me a few more months, a few months to get invited back. But apparently, they decided that it's okay to have me back on. Somebody gave the green light. But initially, they were upset. But I can tell you, I mean, I've got, you can watch the clip of that show on my website. I mean, I wasn't out of line at all. I mean, I wasn't rude to the guy. I asked pertinent questions. And, you know, I mean, that's what you should do. I mean, these guys shouldn't just be able to come on TV and just tout their stocks. I mean, if the journalists want to be objective, they should make them answer that question. I mean, especially in a highly cyclical company like that. And I'm sure, basically, if anybody, you know, heard that, maybe they didn't buy the stock. I mean, I probably did them a service because I'm not even sure, but I'm pretty sure the share price has gone down quite a bit since my appearance. But in any event, if you saw that show, make sure and give me a call at 888-678-9597. Now let's take a quick commercial break, and I'll be back in a minute. All right,
Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, I am back. Anyway, so I was saying, if you saw that interview, the debate on Kudlow, give me a call at 888-678-9597. And also, if you know, any other comments or questions, that is the number to call. I know last couple of shows, we seem to get a lot of calls, you know, towards the middle, towards the end of the program. It's much better to get the calls coming in early. That way we don't get bunched for time at the end, and I don't have to rush through the questions. So definitely try to call more towards the earlier part of the show, and don't just hold off on your calls until the last half of the show. Anyway, you know, Laffer raised, you know, the same points that I've seen him make, you know, over and over again when I've seen him talk, and they're just so incredibly ridiculous. I mean, one of the points that he made was that the American economy has never been better in history than it is now. And I mean, it's just so incredible that somebody could think that, you know, that this is the best it's ever been. You know, throughout the entire period of the Industrial Revolution or any other period, that this is the best the economy has been, you know, better than in periods of time when, you know, we were, you know, building an entire country with infrastructure and industry and lifting, you know, people out of poverty, and people were being transformed from an agrarian society to an industrial society, that somehow the economy today is more dynamic and better, which is absolutely ridiculous. And he pointed out that, he says, you know, we've created all this wealth in the last 5 or 10 years. All this wealth has been created. And, you know, he makes the important, he confuses wealth with asset prices. And a lot of people do this, but theoretically, if the guy is supposed to be an economist, he ought to know better. I mean, how could somebody think that asset prices reflect actual wealth? You know, if a house was, you know, appraised at $500,000 4 years ago, and the identical house is appraised at $1 million today, and assuming that nothing has been done to it, how could that be an addition of $500,000 worth of wealth? Nothing has changed. It's the exact same house. How can we be wealthier when all we have is the same house we had? You know, prices mean nothing. Asset prices are not wealth. Wealth is the stuff. You know, the house represents wealth. Certainly, it represents housing stock. But the house is no more valuable in terms of its ability to provide shelter than it was when it was worth $500,000. You know, real wealth would be additional houses. Now, sure, we've built new houses, quite a few of them actually, over the last 5 years, so that would be additional wealth. I would say that it's probably, an overinvestment of housing at the expense of other things that we needed more, like refineries that we should have built as opposed to houses that we really don't need. But certainly an increase in the housing stock, if we have more houses, that does increase the national wealth. But simply an appraiser assigning a higher value to the identical property than he assigned years ago is not wealth. Similarly, increasing stock prices are not wealth. Just because if the stock goes from 10 times earnings to 20 times earnings, now just because we're saying that the dollars worth of earnings are now worth twice what they used to, that doesn't mean we're any wealthier. We don't have any more earnings, so the companies aren't inherently any more valuable than they were before the prices went up. So because the prices went up, doesn't signify any wealth. What would really be wealth would be increases in our industrial capacity. If we have new plants and new equipment, if we have new mines or new farms, that's wealth, real stuff. Because valuations have nothing to do with wealth, and we know that valuations can change very, very rapidly. I mean, look at the Nasdaq. I mean, the Nasdaq was at 5,000 in 2000, and then by 2002 it was down to 1,000, had an 80% decline. Does that mean we lost 80% of our wealth, or represented by the Nasdaq? No. I mean, on paper, the assets lost value, but they went up too. The Nasdaq went from 1,000 in 1995 to 5,000 in 2000. But the fact that it went up fivefold didn't mean that there was a fivefold increase in wealth or in the component of wealth from the Nasdaq. Now, certain people obviously were able to convert those gains into purchasing power, but that personal purchasing power came at the expense of somebody else. It wasn't anything added. There was no real wealth. And I try to make this point to Laffer that the wealth that he's talking to is an illusion. And, it's a dream. And one day Americans are going to wake up to reality. And that phony wealth is going to be gone. You can particularly see what's going to happen to the real estate market. I mean, look at the numbers that have come out just in the last week. Look at the articles that have been written. You can see the trouble beginning now in the mortgage industry, in the subprime market. The inventory continues to build. I mean, the number of homes on the market right now is the highest it's been since 1993. 1993, there are more homes for sale now than at any time since 1993. Now, 1993 was a completely different environment. The previous real estate market peaked probably in like 89 or 90. 1993, we had already been, a couple of years into a downturn. And, we were near the bottom. Prices probably bottomed out maybe in 94, 95, but I guess inventories peaked in 93. And so that was kind of the low point of the last cycle. And remember, back in 1993, prices in general were probably a third or a quarter of what they are today. I mean, real estate affordability was far, far higher. Even though interest rates were higher, mortgage rates were higher, the amount of money that somebody needed to borrow to buy a house was significantly less. And also, you had a lot more potential buyers out there than you do today. I mean, there were still a lot more people that were out of the market, that were renting, that were there. I mean, now, at this point, we're still near the peak. We've got a record. We've got the highest amount of inventory since 93, but we're still near the peak of the housing market. And they're still building them. They're building them like crazy. I mean, you drive around, and you can see all these spec homes under construction. They're not even on the market yet. They're going to be on the market. And, there's still a lot of property that is not on the market that, speculators bought these properties from developers. And when they bought them, they got locked up. Developers said, okay, you can buy this house, but you can't sell it for 1 year. You can't sell it for 2 years. So all these guys are locked up. But when these lockup periods expire, the for sale signs are going to come out, all over the lawn. And, you know, there's a lot of people, too, that, you know, bought these places on spec. You know, they're going to have to get rid of them, especially when they have adjustable rate mortgages. And, of course, there are a lot of people, I mean, wait over the next year or two, something like $2.5 trillion worth of mortgage debt matures. But a lot of people, you know, when they get their new mortgage payment, they see that it's 30%, 40%, 50% higher, or maybe double what they used to be paying, they might not be able to afford it. The only thing they can do is try to get out from under the mortgage by trying to sell a house. So that property is coming on the market. So this is going to get so much worse as far as the number of homes on the market. Now, the builders are still maintaining the illusion that prices aren't collapsing, because what they're doing is, rather than cutting their price, let's say they're trying to sell a condo, you know, for $800,000, rather than selling it for $760,000, they're still selling it for $800,000, but they're giving the buyer $40,000 worth of kickbacks in the form of upgrades like, you know, media rooms or you know, better kitchens or appliances, or they're leasing a BMW for them for a couple of years, or giving them cash to buy furniture, all sorts of things, which really amount to price cuts. But the developers aren't marketing them that way because they don't want to telegraph to the communities that prices are falling. Now, I think this is also disingenuous on the part of the lenders, because the lenders are financing these transactions as if, you know, they're selling for $800,000, but there really is, they're not. They're selling for less, so you know how phony the appraisals are. But I pointed out to Laffer, look, this wealth that you're talking about is an illusion, and one day America's going to wake up and it's not going to be there. But what's still going to be there is all the debt, and all the mortgage payments still have to be made, even though the equity is gone. Now, of course, they might not be made, because the homeowner can certainly walk away from his mortgage. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a loss there. The loss is now transferred to the lender, and the lenders are going to lose a fortune, an absolute fortune, as the values of these debts are wiped out. And who are the lenders? Who are the lenders? They're insurance companies. They're pension funds. What happens when insurance companies and pension funds take huge losses? Well, that means the average retiree who's depending on those pension funds, you know, he doesn't get his money. Or if insurance companies see their reserves collapse because they invested those reserves in mortgage-backed securities and now they're worth 40 cents on the dollar, they're going to have to raise premiums through the roof in order to be able to replenish those reserves. I mean, the American public is going to get clobbered. You know, I've talked in the past, you know, the biggest losers from this real estate bubble are not necessarily the people who bought real estate, but the people who financed the transactions and maybe indirectly financed them, because people have insurance plans or premiums, or maybe policies. People have policies, or they have pension funds, or, you know, all sorts of, you know, charities have endowments, and everybody's got money invested in these things, and they're going to blow up. Anyway, we've got the first caller on hold from the Faroe Islands. More international calls. Go ahead, Hygram.
Yes, Yaldrim Magnusson. Hi, Jim. Hi, Peter.
How are you?
I'm fine. It's the middle of the night here now, so we're just listening up, me and my friend here.
But where are the Faroe Islands?
It's a part of the Danish kingdom. It's a couple of islands belonging to the Danish kingdom up in the middle of the Atlantic.
Uh-huh.
Up nearby Iceland.
Oh, okay. You're way up there.
Yeah. Anyways, I have a question for you.
Yes.
It's the thing, well, we kind of figured from your programs that the dollar is going to fall significantly or might even collapse. And then we were wondering if we as Europeans or non-holders of U.S. currency should maybe take out loans in dollars and make up for money that way.
I think that borrowing in dollars is definitely the smart thing. I mean, I'm a large shareholder in many companies, but one of these companies I owned in New Zealand years and years ago, I suggested to the management, because they had a bunch of debt, and I said, look, why don't you pay it off and refinance in U.S. dollars? And, of course, they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to take the currency risk. But I said, look, there's no risk. The dollar's going to get killed. I mean, I think the currency you want to borrow in is dollars. I mean, if you can do it. So, I mean, I don't know if how easy it is, you know, if you're in a Danish, you know, province or someplace that uses the euro, to go and take out a mortgage against your property denominated in dollars. But obviously, you know, that's what you want to do. If you're borrowing money, you want to borrow money that's going to lose value because it makes it easier to repay it. So to the extent that that's possible for you, that you already have debt in euros, I think you'd be much better off if you could do it to transfer that debt to dollars. Obviously.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. We actually asked our bank, and they said that it could be done. So we're thinking basically taking, I have student loan and stuff like that. So if you could put it all over into dollars, then that would be a more financially wise decision, I would think.
I think so. I mean, dollars got no way to go but down, you know. And, I mean, eventually, as more and more people start thinking that way, then the dollar will collapse because everybody's going to be trying to borrow them, and it's just going to push the value down. Everyone's going to try to borrow them and sell them. That's what you have to do. People are going to try to, sell dollars because that's basically what the transaction is going to happen. And so ultimately, people doing what you're saying is one of the things that will, hasten the dollar's collapse.
Wonderful, Peter. That was actually my question, and thank you for the advice.
Yep. Okay, well, thanks a lot. Keep on listening. I'm glad to know we've got people overseas tuning in.
Thank you. It's a wonderful program.
Okay, and let me switch. Actually, I want to switch to a better telephone.
Hello? Hello? I think we got James from Los Angeles on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. And I just came online. I don't know if I can formulate this properly, but I've got a good friend that's a trader for a major bank in downtown Los Angeles. And I love your show, and I love you, and I think you're right on the money. But he said that one of the problems with the dollar weakening is that the depth of liquidity of the euro or the yen is not quite where it needs to be yet for them to switch over to, say, another currency. What would your response be to that?
Well, that's a ridiculous argument because, I mean, basically they're saying that the reason the dollar is the reserve is because there's so many of them.
Yes.
But what gives a currency value is the fact that there's few of it. It's scarcity that gives something value. Abundance is not something that's value, makes something valuable. You know, to say, yes, you should own these because there's a ton of them and we're going to keep on printing them, it misses the whole point of what creates value in a fiat currency, and that's scarcity. And so, you know, it doesn't matter. There's plenty of volume in the euro because, you know, the volume could be at a higher price. You know, it doesn't do any good if we're flooding the world with dollars and try to say, hey, look how many there are.
Well, here's an example. My friend said, let's say you wanted to do a billion of, say, treasury bills. To do, or maybe not treasury bills, let's say 10-year notes, and you wanted to do that billion in U.S. treasuries, no problem. If you wanted to do that billion in euro or in yen, then it might take a little
bit. Well, it wouldn't be a problem in euro or yen. I mean, it might be a problem if you try to do it in the Icelandic currency or, but the fact that it's harder to buy the debt, buy corporate debt or, there's not enough government debt, that's a good thing. That means the debt is more valuable. It's more likely to be repaid. I mean, it's all nonsense to say that, look, when the dollar was the reserve currency 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there was a lot less of them than there are today. It didn't stop it from being the reserve currency. I mean, we've flooded the world. Look at the charts of M3. Look at how much
money
is in circulation. And, I mean, that's all nonsense. And, anybody can say, look, there's a lot of currency. I mean, that can't be the reason for your currency to reserve. I mean, look at some of these other countries. It takes several million dollars to buy a cup of coffee. I mean, you could do billions of, in there and no problem. Anybody can just debase their currency and print it.
Well, let me ask you the $64 question. When do you think the dollar will really start to fall? How much longer do we have to wait?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that it's long overdue. I mean, it should have happened years ago, so we're already living on borrowed time. I know there are a lot of vested interests, political, powerful interests, financial interests that have, a reason to try to maintain the status quo, and that's what's been happening. But I think that sometime over the next couple of years would be my guess that it's going to hit the fan. I cannot see how the dollar can maintain itself. Look, the Fed has already paused in raising rates, okay? So the rate hikes are over. And so, if they start to cut rates, then the dollar is dead.
So the question is, how long will the Fed be able to sit here and not cut rates? Because the real estate market is going to roll over. The economy is going to move into a recession. There's no question that that's going to happen, that the economy is going to be in a recession, if not next year, the year after. And what is the government going to do about it? The minute the government tries to do anything about it, the dollar should collapse.
What do you think of that?
Eventually, if they do nothing about it, the dollar will collapse too. So the dollar is going to collapse either way.
What do you think of MetLife's $5 billion worth of property there on the Manhattan?
Oh, that they're trying to sell? Well, you know, I mean, good luck. I mean, I think they're smart to sell it. I heard an interview with Donald Trump. You know, he said he wasn't interested. You know, I actually had an opportunity to meet him the other day. We were sitting in, next to each other at a concert. I talked to him a little bit. And, you know, he's told me he's not building. I mean, he's a little cautious. He seems a little bit more cautious than he seems in public. He doesn't, you know, he left the door open that maybe I could be right, that we could be in for a significant decline. He mainly thinks it's a function of interest rates, and he says if rates go up, then that'll happen. I said pretty much, yeah, rates are going to go up. But at this point, it's a function of supply. I mean, there's so much supply around the world, around the country, that prices are going to go down. But I think MetLife is doing the smart thing, trying to get $5 billion for, you know, basically a bunch of low-income properties in Manhattan. I mean, whoever buys it, you can't even raise the rents. I mean, you got all these old people that have been there forever in these rent-controlled apartments.
Well, that could be the precursor for other large corporations to start unloading, though, don't you think?
Well, the key is we'll see what kind of bids they get. I mean, we'll see if there's actually... I mean, Trump was saying he anticipated, you know, like a buying frenzy. Everybody would want to get this thing. We'll see. I mean, I don't know why anybody would want to buy a big chunk of Manhattan real estate now.
Right. Well, you do a great job, and I take my hat off to you. Someday I may give you a ring and see if I can help out some way. I'm a semi-retired banker. I worked in institutional sales in the bond market.
Well, are you working now, or what?
I'm not working now, but I'm working on some concepts that I think I might want to take to someone like yourself to help wake people up, but not quite so blatantly that you do, because it would shock most people if they really listened and heard what you had to say.
Sure. Well, in the meantime, do you have an account with us?
No, but I've got a lot of gold and silver and platinum.
I mean, well, you can always get some more, do get some money out of the dollar, you know, in some foreign stocks, just in case the collapse takes a little while longer. You know, these foreign assets pay good dividends while we're waiting.
You're absolutely right. I may give you a jingle sometime, Peter, in the near future.
All right. You know, we still have an office out there in California, Newport Beach.
It's a great area, actually.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Peter.
Anyway, we're back. Let me put the telephone number again. I'm still looking for anybody that saw the CNBC debate. The number to call is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And, you know, of course, the other mistake that Laffer made, you know, I mean, he made several. I mean, but the biggest ones, first, you know, was the confusion of asset price inflation or appreciation with legitimate wealth creation. The second one was his comment that the trade deficit is not a problem. And again, he pointed out that we ran trade deficits from like 1690, you know, to, you know, whenever it was, you know, 1900 or 1910 or whenever we started, we turned it around. And said, therefore, there's nothing wrong with a trade deficit. Now, for a guy to say that, I mean, a guy's got to know absolutely nothing. Because in the 1600s, we were a poor country. We were just a colony. We were nobody. We had to borrow money. We didn't have any savings. The pilgrims just landed on Plymouth Rock, right? I mean, of course we had to borrow money. We ran a current account deficit. Of course. But what else would we do? But we didn't borrow so that we could spend money on consumer goods. We borrowed to build a country out of nothing. We borrowed to build factories, to build farms, to buy the equipment necessary, you know, the capital equipment. We ran railroad tracks all over the country, and we built bridges and ports and dams and all sorts of things with that money. And then all of these factories and all this infrastructure enabled us to produce consumer goods that we could sell back to the European creditors so that we could pay back the money we borrowed. Or we didn't squander it. There's a difference between a poor country borrowing to produce and a rich country borrowing to consume. It's apples and oranges, right? I mean, the way a poor country gets rich is it borrows to produce. The way a rich country gets poor is they borrow to consume. But Art Laffer doesn't know the difference. He doesn't see the difference between borrowing to build a factory and borrowing to take a vacation. You know, it's amazing. I don't even know how these guys can call themselves economists. How can this guy be so highly rated? You know, the guy was in the Reagan administration. He's got this reputation. And, I mean, this is absolute nonsense. I mean, pure, unadulterated nonsense that somebody can actually be so confused about something so basic. I mean, that's like a guy claiming to be a mathematician, and he thinks 2 and 2 is 5. I mean, that's how he adds them up. That's how basic this mistake is, to claim to be an economist and not understand the difference between consumer debt and capital debt. I mean, consumer debt is a cancer on an economy. I mean, how you borrow to consume, you've got nothing to show for it. You borrow to build a factory, you got a factory. You got an asset that can produce products. You've got real wealth. You borrow to take a vacation or to buy a television set. I mean, well, you don't have to, what are you going to do? Plus the television set, in 4 or 5 years, it's obsolete. You know, it depreciates. It doesn't produce anything. You can't use it. I mean, how are you going to pay off your debts? If you borrow money from the Japanese and buy one of their TV sets, how does owning that TV set help you pay off your debt? I mean, is watching it somehow going to produce income for you? I guess unless you're going to take that TV set and sell tickets to DVDs and serve popcorn in your house and charge money. Yeah, it doesn't, you don't do anything. I mean, you're worse off. You know, I mean, the country is worse off when you borrow to consume. I mean, if we can't afford products now and we have to borrow money to consume, how are we going to pay back? We're deeper in debt. But when you borrow and build a factory, the factory turns out products. Now you sell the products. That retires the debt. That helps you pay off the debt. They're self-liquidating. They make sense, right? It makes sense to do that. I mean, sometimes it makes sense, I guess, for somebody to borrow. Let's say you want to get a job, and you know you can't get a job if you don't have any clothes. You got to have a couple of suits. So if you don't have any money and you have to borrow a little bit of money to buy a suit, all right, well that might make sense because you know without that suit you're not going to get a job and you can't get employed naked. But you know you don't have to. You know, but then you know you don't have to keep buying more. You know, more leisure clothes. I mean, or more suits. Or you know, like it makes sense to borrow to buy a car if you need the car to get to and from work, and without the car you couldn't get a job. But, you know, a Honda will do that. It doesn't make any sense to borrow to buy a BMW. If you can't afford to pay cash for the BMW, what the hell are you doing buying it? You know, I mean, you know, you don't need to go to work in a BMW if you have to borrow the money. You know, you could buy an economy car. But certainly sometimes you do need to borrow for consumer things because, you know, but in general, no. I mean, you know, people are buying, you know, pure consumption. There's things that they don't necessarily need. They certainly like them, or they're enjoyable, but you know, you can't afford them. And we're going into debt. And for Art Laffer not to see the difference between profligate Americans blowing money on consumption and running up debt versus hardworking Americans 200 years ago borrowing to build up a country and to build up a nation. I mean, this is amazing, absolutely amazing. And I want to know if anybody saw this debate and if anybody had these thoughts running through their head. Anyway, the number to call, the lines are free. The number are open. The number to call is 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. Now we got the GMP numbers came out today. And I think we got 2.9% for the quarter, the preliminary look. So, I mean, things are slowing down the way they measure this. But I still say that inflation is being understated and that much of that decline is actually nominal and not real, and that if inflation were being accurately reported, that the GMP would probably already be in a contraction mode. But that number's out. I think the big number comes out, the jobs number comes out on Friday. And again, I always look for these jobs numbers to be on the weak side, and I would think this would be no exception. I still think that we are destroying meaningful jobs. I mean, we're running these big trade deficits, so if we're buying imported goods, the spending isn't necessarily translating into employment here. It might be translating into employment in China, but it's certainly not doing anything here. So I think we're still going to have weaker economic data. You know, talking about foolish things that I heard said on CNBC, I'm not necessarily picking on CNBC, I just happen to have it on quite a bit. But Steve Leeson, who's our economist there, was trying to explain to one of the other guests, and I put the word explain in quotations, why it is that oil prices could keep rising and other commodity prices could keep rising, but that we're not going to have any inflation, or that consumer prices in America aren't going to rise. And his example was, he said, look, what if you got a meat grinder? What if you have a meat grinder and you are grinding meat, and the cost of the meat keeps rising. The cost of the meat keeps rising, but the wages that are paid to the grinder itself are falling, such that the hamburger that's coming out is actually less expensive, even though the meat became more expensive. And there's a huge problem with that analogy. And I want to continue with this in just 1 second. I need to take a quick break. So let's play the commercial, and I'm going to finish up with why that analogy is flawed in a minute.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we're back. And again, the lines are open. Let me give out the telephone number again to call. It is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Getting back to Stephen Leisman's meat grinder example, what he was referring to was the fact that China, right, the Chinese, are importing or consuming all this high-priced oil and lead and copper and zinc and nickel and you name it, but the fact that they're working for such cheap wages and that the wages keep falling, and he was envisioning, you know, more cheap labor coming. That the net result was that going to be the actual price of these products, once they get shipped to the United States, was going to be lower. And so it didn't matter how much more expensive energy was, that we were going to, that the cheap labor was going to offset that. Now the problem is basically what Steve Leisman is assuming, that these Chinese meat grinders are going to continuously accept lower and lower wages to grind meat to make hamburgers for Americans while they go hungry. Now, I don't think this is going to happen. I'm not going to bet that these guys are going to do that. It doesn't make sense that they're going to hunger and they're going to be eating, you know, rice while the hamburger that they're grinding is going to Americans who are eating good and are fat, but we don't have any of this. We don't have any of the grinding material. We don't have the machines. We can't make the meat ourselves. What's ultimately going to happen is the Chinese meat grinders are going to say, this is ridiculous. I want higher wages. I want more money. I want to eat this meat myself. I don't want to send it to America. I want to eat these hamburgers. And that's what's going to happen. I mean, sure that we have this temporary situation where we're living off the cheap labor of the rest of the world. But the rest of the world's labor isn't going to stay cheap. You know, I mean, you can look at it in stages, right? America used to produce everything, so America was able to consume everything. We consumed because we produced. It wasn't the other way around. Well, now the production has shifted over to Asia, to China and other parts of the world. But the consumption is still in America. Well, the completion of this transformation is the second end of it. The production has gone offshore. The next thing that happens is the consumption is going to go offshore. It's going to follow production. The people who produce it, they're the ones that get to consume it. That second leg hasn't happened yet. We haven't completed the process of the transformation, but it's going to. I mean, people like Leisman are going to assume that the rest of the world is going to take over the consumption, production rather, but for some reason the consumption is going to stay in America. And that just doesn't make any sense. Like, they're going to take the hard part. They're going to take the work off our hands, right? They're going to grow all the fruit, but we're still going to get to eat it. That ain't going to happen. Now, the question is, how much longer is this going to go on? How long are they going to keep grinding our meat and accepting low wages to do it? I think it's coming down. In fact, if you look at the yuan, hit a new all-time record high yesterday against the dollar. Now, again, these are just minor moves, you know, but, you know, it's going to snowball. It's going to snowball. It's not, you know, and at some point it's really going to start to move. I mean, because that's how the Chinese are going to get more money. That's how they're going to get higher wages, is going to be through an appreciation of their currency. Because that's a raise. When your currency gains value, you in effect have a raise. You've got more purchasing power. You know, you don't have to have more, you know, you don't have to actually get a raise in terms of how much yuan you're earning. If your yuan gained value, then you can buy more stuff with the same quantity. And that's what's going to happen. And, you know, I don't know what these guys are going to be saying in whatever it is, 6 months or a year or two, when it happens. But it's amazing how many people, you know, I see all these people going on television that I debate with. I saw that Diane Swank on again today, on Kudlow saying stuff, and other economists. I mean, all these people are out there as if they're experts, talking about, you know, what's going to happen in this, the economy, and what the Fed should do. And they're all clueless. None of them knows anything. If they knew anything about economics, they'd be saying the same stuff I am. But they don't. They don't know a thing. And the public thinks that these guys are actually experts. They actually know what they're talking about. And they don't know anything. I mean, they probably know less than the reporters who are interviewing them, you know, which is a huge leap. And they probably know less than most of the Americans who are watching on television, who think that they're listening to some expert. Because in many cases, the stuff that they says just contradicts common sense. You know? But they get up there and they still, you know, have the word, you know, economist after their name. And that's got to be one of the easiest titles to get as economist, you know, chief economist, senior economist. I mean, what do you need anyway before somebody refers to you as an economist? You know, I mean, you don't really have to know anything, you know. All you have to do is go on there and say how great things are and how wonderful the economy is and just say, well, I think the Fed should pause. They should hike a quarter, lower. I mean, anybody can say this stuff. I don't even know if these people actually realize how little they know. You know, a lot of these people might actually think they know something. I mean, that's how clueless they are. They actually believe they know what they're talking about. You know, I mean, maybe some of them will admit that they're absolutely clueless and they have no idea what's going to happen or what they're saying. But, you know, they're collecting a paycheck. And they went to school and they majored in economics, so now they're an economist. But I don't even know why we have a Council of Economic Advisors. I mean, why does the president, why do we waste all this money, the federal government, on all these economic advisors? I mean, we're running a huge trade deficit, a huge current account deficit. We have negative savings rate. We have a huge budget deficit. We have huge unfunded liabilities. I mean, what the hell good are we? Why don't we fire all these economic advisors? I mean, what do we need them for? I mean, we couldn't be doing any worse if we didn't have any. I mean, I can see, you know, if things were going better, if we had record trade surpluses and, you know, all right, then maybe you could say, okay, look, you know, these guys have given us the good advice. But obviously, whatever advice they've given us over the years has been a disaster. The economy is a basket case. So why not at least save the money and get rid of all these economists? I mean, there's no reason to have them. But what the hell are they doing? Anyway, the number to call again, we have nothing but free lines. It's 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Now, oil prices have gotten back below $70 a barrel again. You know, every time they go back down, you know, below 70, you know, you'd think they were back at 30, the way the media reports on the oil price dropping, I mean, it's not dropping. We're 69 change. These are still high oil prices relative to where they were. I think, you know, we're building a nice base in this area, and, you know, the next move is going to be up. I think the most recent drop in the crude price is a function of the fact that the markets had seen this Ernesto building, and maybe some people had bought natural gas or bought crude oil anticipating that Ernesto was going to move through the Gulf of Mexico and disrupt something. And when it didn't happen, a lot of those speculative buys are being unwound, and obviously they're all doing it at the same time, and so the price is going down. If anything, it's a buying opportunity. You know, I see people on television talking about, aha, this is the top of the crude oil market, this is the top, we're going down. I mean, people have been predicting the top of the crude oil market since it got to $25 or $30 a barrel. You know, $35 is the top. Oh, no, $40 is the top. $45, well, $50's got to be the top. Oh, it's $6.55, $60. I mean, people have been looking for tops, you know, for the entire move. And I think, you know, that's a very healthy sign of the bull market, that there's so many people trying to pick the top. And the minute it pauses, there's all these people jumping up and down. You see at the top, the market's going down. Don't believe it. This is a bull market. Nothing has changed. And I think we're still going higher. I think we're going a lot higher, particularly in terms of U.S. dollars. Anyway, we do have another call from our neighbors to the north up in Canada. We got Ed from Toronto. Go ahead, Ed. Ed, can you hear me? Do we have Ed on the line? Ed?
Yeah?
You want to turn down your radio and you can talk?
Sure.
What's on your mind today?
No, you know what? I was thinking exactly what he was thinking, but coming at it from another way, I was thinking that at what point do the Asians stop supporting the dollar, right? And I thought that at some point, considering the rise in commodity prices, it's to their benefit to let the U.S. economy go by lowering the dollar, because it'll bring down the prices of the commodities that they're buying.
Well, of course. That's the easiest way to reduce their costs.
Yeah.
Is to let the dollar go down, and then the yuan price of commodities will fall.
That's right. You know, and commodity prices will come down as well, which is good for them.
They'll come down in terms of yuan. They'll probably go up in terms of the dollar.
Totally. But that'll make it, the cost perspective for Americans is going to even...
But also, more importantly, for the Chinese, see, what everybody is missing the point is that rather than manufacturing these products and shipping them to America,
as well spend them internally, buy them internally.
Just manufacture the products, and instead of them being on the shelves of Walmart in the United States, they'll be on the shelves of Walmart or some other store in China.
Totally agree. But
yeah, instead of Americans getting the benefit of buying them, the Chinese will get the benefit of buying them. I mean, and they're much better off, right? They're much better off with the products than without them.
No, exactly.
That's what these economists keep overlooking, the fact that the whole idea is to get consumer goods. The whole idea of an economy is to efficiently produce more consumer goods. That's, you know, all capital investment, all the factories that are there, everything we have, there's only one goal, to make consumer goods.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants a factory because they want a factory. They want a factory because of what it produces, what consumer goods is going to make.
Right.
So if China has all these factories, but they don't get to keep any of the consumer goods, I mean, what the hell good are the factories to the Chinese?
True.
Oh, wait a minute. You know, and people don't work for the pleasure of working.
Mm-hmm.
They work because of the consumer goods that work enables them to have.
That's right.
So
quality of life.
It's a job if you don't have anything to show for it. I mean, if you don't work for the sake of working, you don't want factories for the sake of having factories. They're not like they're beautiful. You know, in the landscape, we just want to admire how pretty they are.
Yeah.
You know, we are basically robbing the Chinese of all the benefits of their capital investment, the benefits of their labor, because we're getting to consume all the stuff they produce.
Totally. Yeah. No, I hear you. Great show, by the way. Hey, what do you think are going to be the effects of a war with Iran on the U.S. economy, considering how weak it is?
Look, I mean, obviously the U.S. has got itself entangled with military, you know, all over the world. We've got commitments, we're spending money, and we're spending money we don't have. I mean, we're having to go into debt. I mean, it's one thing for a rich country to extend its empire around the world. It's another thing for a poor country.
And that's right.
I think America is, in fact, a poor country. I mean, we don't consume like a poor country, but our balance sheet is like a poor country.
That's right. They're living beyond their...
like a poor country, you know. And one day we'll live like a poor country.
Yeah.
You know, now, we might not stay poor forever. We do have a lot of potential. But right now, that's not the situation.
Yeah.
You know, and that we're like the profligate.
Well, it's like the Brits and the Romans and, you know, it's
look,
in history.
We inherited a lot of money from our rich uncle.
Yeah.
And we've been blowing it ever since.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, our rich uncle is the one that earned it because he worked hard and built up a business, and all we're doing is spending the money. And so we, you know, we shouldn't be confused with him. Just because we're spending his money doesn't mean that it's the same situation. We're just blowing it.
Oh, by the way.
On, you know.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, last week you quoted Bob Marley. It wasn't, I can't remember who the hell you said it was, but it wasn't who it was. It was Bob Marley. You can fool some people sometime, but you can't fool all the people all the time.
What was it? What was it that wasn't that Abe Lincoln?
No, it's Bob Marley. It's one of his songs.
Oh well, he.
There you go.
When did he write it?
Oh, I don't know. He's dead now. And it was I can't remember the name of it. Rise Up, Get Up. I can't remember the name of the song, but I did hear it on the weekend. Anyways, you got a great show. Keep it up.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends up there in Canada. We got a word up there.
I have been. I think, you know, being here in Canada, I feel pretty good, considering that we have so many resources. But I do feel, you know, I think we're watching the world's going to be very different in 10 to 15 years.
Well, it's probably going to be very different in just a couple of years. You don't have to wait 10 to 15.
Well, as far as the U.S. is concerned, you know, there's...
I mean, the U.S. is done for time, and it's, you know, it's not going to last too much longer. I mean, I think this whole act is going to play out over the next couple of years, and barring any complete unforeseen miracle that, you know, could buy us some more time.
Yeah.
Which would actually be counterproductive, and it would just mean that the ultimate demise would be that much more dramatic.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully everything can at least stay intact until March, because that's when my book comes out. So.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think it will. But my broker has similar opinions to what you're saying, and he was saying that because of the changes are going to be so profound, you know, to take a completely separate approach here in terms of how you invest your money, and you know, and people don't see it. Like I look at the housing sector. Right, we've been shorting the housing sector, and these stocks are running up, and the numbers that are coming out, and it hasn't even started. Did you read, what's his name, the guy from PIMCO?
Bill Gross, what about him?
Bill Gross, the September issue is all about what you're talking about. Like, it's funny, this guy's talking about it. It was, you know, when guys like that start saying things. Hang on, I have it on the net right here. Let me read it to you.
I mean, Bill Gross has been saying some of this stuff for years and years and years. But, I mean, they're way off base right now on PIMCO because these guys are looking for a bond, you know, a big bond rally. And I just don't...
I agree, but that doesn't go with what he's been saying. Like, some of the stuff he's been saying, you know, it's pretty, you know, right along your line as well. And I agree with you guys. It doesn't look good. Anyways,
nope.
I gotta go.
Anyway, thanks for the call, and keep on listening. Yeah, you know, a lot of people just are under the impression that, you know, we've got a long time, that this is, you know, these problems are gonna surface, but not for, you know, 10 or 20 years or 30 years. And, you know, I just can't see that. I mean, I guess anything is possible. Anything is possible. But I would not want to bet on that kind of outcome. I wouldn't want to assume that we've got anywhere near that kind of time. And I would just, at this point, be operating under the assumption that, you know, the bottom is going to fall out of this thing tomorrow. And just make sure that your financial assets are in order. And that means don't have dollars. You know, it's like, you know, that game, musical chairs, you know, we all played that game as a kid. You got to make sure you're sitting in a chair when the music stops, because if you're not in a chair, you're out of the game. Well, when the music stops in the currency market, you've got to make sure that you don't own any dollars, because when it stops and you've got some, you're stuck with them, they're worthless, you're out of the game, you lose. And you don't know when the music is going to stop. You know, just like in musical chairs, you don't know, right? You're just playing, and all of a sudden, the person yanks up the arm on the controller. You know, at least that's how we used to play it back when we still had records. And so you don't know. And everybody's, you know, dancing along to this tune in the United States, and all of a sudden, one second, we're all going to wake up, and somebody in China or someone in Japan lifted up the needle off the record, and the music stops. And if you're still in U.S. dollars and U.S. dollar assets, when that happens, it's too late. So you got to act. You got to act sooner rather than later. And that means, you know, if you are a Euro Pacific Capital client and we only have a small percentage of your overall portfolio, you need to get on the phone. You need to call up whoever you're working with and make arrangements to transfer more money over here so that we can get it out of the dollar. You know, you can always, you know, we can talk about moving back to domestic investments at some point in the future, but right now you got to, you know, you got to get out of this predicament. You got to get a seat in the chair before this music stops. If you're not a Euro Pacific Capital client, that means you got to quickly pick up the phone and you got to become one. And you've got to start moving money out of the dollar before it's too late. We could talk to you about all the various stocks around the world that we like and why we like them and the countries that we're investing in and the dividend yields that we can get you. But it's very important that you do that. Anyway, what you want to do is, you know, you want to call us. The telephone number to call is 800-727-7922. 800-727-7922. You know, we also have a California office, Newport Beach, 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350, and we've got an office in Phoenix. Their toll-free number is 800-727-6435, 800-727-6435. You know, also in addition to foreign stocks, we're recommending gold and silver. Silver is just looking really strong to me. I think, you know, it's trading around $12.50. I think the chart looks incredible. I think we're getting ready for an explosive move to the upside in silver and gold as well, but I think silver will lead the way. And the Perth Mint, we sell mainly out of any of the brokers can buy Perth Mint gold and silver. But at Newport Beach, Danielle Dwyer, 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350. Again, we're running out of time. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, visit the website at www.europac.net, www.eurocap.net.